Intuition adds value even in the justly derided selection interview, but only after a disciplined collection of objective information and disciplined scoring of separate traits. I set a formula that gave the close your eyes evaluation the same weight as the sum of the six trait ratings. A more general lesson that I learned from this episode was do not simply trust intuitive judgment, your own or that of others, but do not dismiss it either. Some 45 years later, after I won a Nobel Prize in economics, I was for a short time a minor celebrity in Israel. On one of my visits, someone had the idea of escorting me around my old army base, which still housed the unit that interviews new recruits. I was introduced to the commanding officer of the psychological unit, and she described their current interviewing practices, which had not changed much from the system I had designed. There was, it turned out, a considerable amount of research indicating that the interviews still worked well. As she came to the end of her description of how the interviews are conducted, the officer added, "And then we tell them, close your eyes." Do it yourself. The message of this chapter is readily applicable to tasks other than making manpower decisions for an army. Implementing interview procedures in the spirit of Meal and Dawes requires relatively little effort but substantial discipline. Suppose that you need to hire a sales representative for your firm. If you are serious about hiring the best possible person for the job, this is what you should do. First, select a few traits that are prerequisites for success in this position: technical proficiency, engaging personality, reliability, and so on. Don't overdo it. Six dimensions is a good number. The traits you choose should be as independent as possible from each other, and you should feel that you can assess them reliably by asking a few factual questions. Next, make a list of those questions for each trait and think about how you will score it, say on a 1 to 5 scale. You should have an idea of what you will call very weak or very strong. These preparations should take you half an hour or so, a small investment that can make a significant difference in the quality of the people you hire. To avoid halo effects, you must collect the information on one trait at a time, scoring each before you move on to the next one. Do not skip around. To evaluate each candidate, add up the 6 scores. Because you are in charge of the final decision, you should not do a close your eyes. Firmly resolve that you will hire the candidate whose final score is the highest, even if there is another one whom you like better. Try to resist your wish to invent broken legs or change the ranking. A vast amount of research offers a promise. You are much more likely to find the best candidate if you use this procedure than if you do what people normally do in such situations, which is go into the interview unprepared and to make choices by an overall intuitive judgment, such as, "I looked into his eyes and I liked what I saw." Speaking of judgments versus formulas. Whenever we can replace human judgment by a formula, we should at least consider it. He thinks his judgments are complex and subtle, but a simple combination of scores could probably do better. Let's decide in advance what weight to give the data we have on the candidate's past performance. Otherwise, we will give too much weight to our impression from the interviews. Chapter 22. Expert Intuition. When can we trust it? Professional controversies bring out the worst in academics. Scientific journals occasionally publish exchanges, often beginning with someone's critique of another's research, followed by a reply and a rejoinder. I have always thought that these exchanges are a waste of time, especially when the original critique is sharply worded. The reply and the rejoinder are often exercises in what I have called sarcasm for beginners and advanced sarcasm. The replies rarely concede anything to a biting critique, and it is almost unheard of for a rejoinder to admit that the original critique was misguided or erroneous in any way. On a few occasions, I have responded to criticisms that I thought were grossly misleading because a failure to respond can be interpreted as conceding error, but I have never found the hostile exchanges instructive. In search of another way to deal with disagreements, I have engaged in a few adversarial collaborations in which scholars who disagree on the science agree to write a jointly authored paper on their differences and sometimes conduct research together. In especially tense situations, the research is moderated by an arbiter. My most satisfying and productive adversarial collaboration was with Gary Klein, the intellectual leader of an association of scholars and practitioners who do not like the kind of work I do. They call themselves Students of Naturalistic Decision-Making, or NDM, and mostly work in organizations where they often study how experts work. The NDMers adamantly reject the focus on biases in the heuristics and biases approach. They criticize this model as overly concerned with failures and driven by artificial experiments rather than by the study of real people doing things that matter. They are deeply skeptical about the value of using rigid algorithms to replace human judgment, and Paul Meehl is not among their heroes. Gary Klein has eloquently articulated this position over many years. This is hardly the basis for a beautiful friendship, but there is more to the story. I had never believed that intuition is always misguided. I had also been a fan of Klein's studies of expertise in firefighters since I first saw a draft of a paper he wrote in the 1970s and was impressed by his book, Sources of Power, much of which analyzes how experienced professionals develop intuitive skills. I invited him to join in an effort to map the boundary that separates the marvels of intuition from its flaws. He was intrigued by the idea, and we went ahead with the project, with no certainty that it would succeed. We set out to answer a specific question. When can you trust an experienced professional who claims to have an intuition? It was obvious that Klein would be more disposed to be trusting, and I would be more skeptical. But could we agree on principles for answering the general question? Over 7 or 8 years, we had many discussions, resolved many disagreements, almost blew up more than once, wrote many drafts, became friends, and eventually published a joint article with a title that tells the story. Conditions for Intuitive Expertise, A Failure to Disagree. Indeed, we did not encounter real issues on which we disagreed, but we did not really agree. Marvels and Flaws. Malcolm Gladwell's bestseller, Blink, appeared while Klein and I were working on the project, and it was reassuring to find ourselves in agreement about it. Gladwell's book opens with the memorable story of art experts faced with an object that is described as a magnificent example of a kouros, a sculpture of a striding boy. Several of the experts had strong visceral reactions. They felt in their gut that the statue was a fake, but were not able to articulate what it was about it that made them uneasy. Everyone who read the book, millions did, remembers that story as a triumph of intuition. The experts agreed that they knew the sculpture was a fake without knowing how they knew, the very definition of intuition. The story appears to imply that a systematic search for the cue that guided the experts would have failed. But Klein and I both rejected that conclusion. From our point of view, such an inquiry was needed, and if it had been conducted properly, which Klein knows how to do, it would probably have succeeded. Although many readers of the Kouros example were surely drawn to an almost magical view of expert intuition, Gladwell himself does not hold that position. In a later chapter, he describes a massive failure of intuition. Americans elected President Harding, whose only qualification for the position was that he perfectly looked the part. Square-jawed and tall, he was the perfect image of a strong and decisive leader. People voted for someone who looked strong and decisive without any other reason to believe that he was. An intuitive prediction of how Harding would perform as president arose from substituting one question for another. A reader of this book should expect such an intuition to be held with confidence. Intuition as recognition. The early experiences that shaped Klein's views of intuition were starkly different from mine. My thinking was formed by observing the illusion of validity in myself and by reading Paul Meehl's demonstrations of the inferiority of clinical prediction. In contrast, Klein's views were shaped by his early studies of fireground commanders, the leaders of firefighting teams. He followed them as they fought fires and later interviewed the leader about his thoughts as he made decisions. As Klein described it in our joint article, he and his collaborators investigated how the commanders could make good decisions without comparing options. The initial hypothesis was that commanders would restrict their analysis to only a pair of options, but that hypothesis proved to be incorrect. In fact, the commanders usually generated only a single option, and that was all they needed. They could draw on the repertoire of patterns that they had compiled during more than a decade of both real and virtual experience to identify a plausible option, which they considered first. They evaluated this option by mentally simulating it to see if it would work in the situation they were facing. If the course of action they were considering seemed appropriate, they would implement it. If it had shortcomings, they would modify it. If they could not easily modify it, they would turn to the next most plausible option and run through the same procedure until an acceptable course of action was found. Klein elaborated this description into a theory of decision-making that he called the Recognition-Primed Decision Model, RPD, which applies to firefighters but also describes expertise in other domains, including chess. The process involves both System 1 and System 2. In the first phase, a tentative plan comes to mind by an automatic function of associative memory, System 1. The next phase is a deliberate process in which the plan is mentally simulated to check if it will work, an operation of System 2. The model of intuitive decision-making as pattern recognition develops ideas presented some time ago by Herbert Simon, perhaps the only scholar who is recognized and admired as a hero and founding figure by all the competing clans and tribes in the study of decision-making. I quoted Herbert Simon's definition of intuition in the introduction, but it will make more sense when I repeat it now. The situation has provided a cue. This cue has given the expert access to information stored in memory, and the information provides the answer. Intuition is nothing more and nothing less than recognition. This strong statement reduces the apparent magic of intuition to the everyday experience of memory. We marvel at the story of the firefighter who has a sudden urge to escape a burning house just before it collapses because the firefighter knows the danger intuitively, without knowing how he knows. However, we also do not know how we immediately know that a person we see as we enter a room is our friend Peter. The moral of Simon's remark is that the mystery of knowing without knowing is not a distinctive feature of intuition. It is the norm of mental life. Acquiring skill. How does the information that supports intuition get stored in memory? Certain types of intuitions are acquired very quickly. We have inherited from our ancestors a great facility to learn when to be afraid. Indeed, one experience is often sufficient to establish a long-term aversion and fear. Many of us have had the visceral memory of a single dubious dish that still leaves us vaguely reluctant to return to a restaurant. All of us tense up when we approach a spot in which an unpleasant event occurred, even when there is no reason to expect it to happen again. For me, one such place is the ramp leading to the San Francisco airport, where years ago, a driver in the throes of road rage followed me from the freeway, rolled down his window, and hurled obscenities at me. I never knew what caused his hatred, but I remember his voice whenever I reached that point on my way to the airport. My memory of the airport incident is conscious, and it fully explains the emotion that comes with it. On many occasions, however, you may feel uneasy in a particular place or when someone uses a particular turn of phrase without having a conscious memory of the triggering event. In hindsight, you will label that unease an intuition if it is followed by a bad experience. This mode of emotional learning is closely related to what happened in Pavlov's famous conditioning experiments, in which dogs learned to recognize the sound of the bell as a signal that food was coming. What Pavlov's dogs learned can be described as a learned hope. Learned fears are even more easily acquired. Fear can also be learned, quite easily in fact, by words rather than by experience. The fireman who had the sixth sense of danger had certainly had many occasions to discuss and think about types of fires he was not involved in, and to rehearse in his mind what the cues might be and how he should react. As I remember from experience, a young platoon commander with no experience of combat will tense up while leading troops through a narrowing ravine because he was taught to identify the terrain as favoring an ambush. Little repetition is needed for learning. Emotional learning may be quick, but what we consider as expertise usually takes a long time to develop. The acquisition of expertise in complex tasks such as high-level chess, professional basketball, or firefighting is intricate and slow, because expertise in a domain is not a single skill, but rather a large collection of mini-skills. Chess is a good example. An expert player can understand a complex position at a glance, but it takes years to develop that level of ability. Studies of chess masters have shown that at least 10,000 hours of dedicated practice, about 6 years of playing chess 5 hours a day, are required to attain the highest levels of performance. During those hours of intense concentration, a serious chess player becomes familiar with thousands of configurations, each consisting of an arrangement of related pieces that can threaten or defend each other. Learning high-level chess can be compared to learning to read. A first grader works hard at recognizing individual letters and assembling them into syllables and words, but a good adult reader perceives entire clauses. An expert reader has also acquired the ability to assemble familiar elements in a new pattern and can quickly recognize and correctly pronounce a word that she has never seen before. In chess, recurrent patterns of interacting pieces play the role of letters, and a chess position is a long word or a sentence. A skilled reader who sees it for the first time will be able to read the opening stanza of Lewis Carroll's Jabberwocky with perfect rhythm and intonation, as well as pleasure. "'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogroves, and the mome raths outgrabe." Acquiring expertise in chess is harder and slower than learning to read because there are many more letters in the alphabet of chess and because the words consist of many letters. After thousands of hours of practice, however, chess masters are able to read a chess situation at a glance. The few moves that come to their mind are almost always strong and sometimes creative. They can deal with a word they have never encountered, and they can find a new way to interpret a familiar one. The environment of skill. Klein and I quickly found that we agreed both on the nature of intuitive skill and on how it is acquired. We still needed to agree on our key question. When can you trust a self-confident professional who claims to have an intuition? We eventually concluded that our disagreement was due in part to the fact that we had different experts in mind. Klein had spent much time with the fire ground commanders, clinical nurses, and other professionals who have real expertise. I had spent more time thinking about clinicians, stock pickers, and political scientists trying to make unsupportable long-term forecasts. Not surprisingly, his default attitude was trust and respect. Mine was skepticism. He was more willing to trust experts who claim an intuition because, as he told me, true experts know the limits of their knowledge. I argued that there are many pseudo-experts who have no idea that they do not know what they are doing, the illusion of validity, and that as a general proposition, subjective confidence is commonly too high and often uninformative. Earlier, I traced people's confidence in a belief to two related impressions, cognitive ease and coherence. We are confident when the story we tell ourselves comes easily to mind, with no contradiction and no competing scenario. But ease and coherence do not guarantee that a belief held with confidence is true. The associative machine is set to suppress doubt and to evoke ideas and information that are compatible with the currently dominant story. A mind that follows "what you see is all there is" will achieve high confidence much too easily by ignoring what it does not know. It is therefore not surprising that many of us are prone to have high confidence in unfounded intuitions. Klein and I eventually agreed on an important principle. The confidence that people have in their intuitions is not a reliable guide to their validity. In other words, do not trust anyone, including yourself, to tell you how much you should trust their judgment. If subjective confidence is not to be trusted, how can we evaluate the probable validity of an intuitive judgment? When do judgments reflect true expertise? When do they display an illusion of validity? The answer comes from the two basic conditions for acquiring a skill: an environment that is sufficiently regular to be predictable, an opportunity to learn these regularities through prolonged practice. When both these conditions are satisfied, intuitions are likely to be skilled. Chess is an extreme example of a regular environment, but bridge and poker also provide robust statistical regularities that can support skill. Physicians, nurses, athletes, and firefighters also face complex but fundamentally orderly situations. The accurate intuitions that Gary Klein has described are due to highly valid cues that the expert's System 1 has learned to use, even if System 2 has not learned to name them. In contrast, stock pickers and political scientists who make long-term forecasts operate in a zero validity environment. Their failures reflect the basic unpredictability of the events that they try to forecast. Some environments are worse than irregular. Robin Hogarth described wicked environments in which professionals are likely to learn the wrong lessons from experience. He borrows from Lewis Thomas the example of a physician in the early 20th century who often had intuitions about patients who were about to develop typhoid. Unfortunately, he tested his hunch by palpating the patient's tongue without washing his hands between patients. When patient after patient became ill, the physician developed a sense of clinical infallibility. His predictions were accurate, but not because he was exercising professional intuition. Meal's clinicians were not inept, and their failure was not due to lack of talent. They performed poorly because they were assigned tasks that did not have a simple solution. The clinician's predicament was less extreme than the zero-validity environment of long-term political forecasting, but they operated in low-validity situations that did not allow high accuracy. We know this to be the case because the best statistical algorithms, although more accurate than human judges, were never very accurate. Indeed, the studies by Meal and his followers never produced a smoking gun demonstration, a case in which clinicians completely missed a highly valid cue that the algorithm detected. An extreme failure of this kind is unlikely because human learning is normally efficient. If a strong predictive cue exists, human observers will find it, given a decent opportunity to do so. Statistical algorithms greatly outdo humans in noisy environments for two reasons. They are more likely than human judges to detect weakly valid cues, and much more likely to maintain a modest level of accuracy by using such cues consistently. It is wrong to blame anyone for failing to forecast accurately in an unpredictable world. However, it seems fair to blame professionals for believing they can succeed in an impossible task. Claims for correct intuitions in an unpredictable situation are self-delusional at best, sometimes worse. In the absence of valid cues, intuitive hits are due either to luck or to lies. If you find this conclusion surprising, you still have a lingering belief that intuition is magic. Remember this rule. Intuition cannot be trusted in the absence of stable regularities in the environment. Feedback and practice. Some regularities in the environment are easier to discover and apply than others. Think of how you developed your style of using the brakes on your car. As you were mastering the skill of taking curves, you gradually learned when to let go of the accelerator and when and how hard to use the brakes. Curves differ, and the variability you experienced while learning ensures that you are now ready to brake at the right time and strength for any curve you encounter. The conditions for learning this skill are ideal, because you receive immediate and unambiguous feedback every time you go around a bend. The mild reward of a comfortable turn, or the mild punishment of some difficulty in handling the car if you brake either too hard or not quite hard enough. The situations that face a harbor pilot maneuvering large ships are no less regular, but skill is much more difficult to acquire by sheer experience because of the long delay between actions and their noticeable outcomes. Whether professionals have a chance to develop intuitive expertise depends essentially on the quality and speed of feedback, as well as on sufficient opportunity to practice. Expertise is not a single skill. It is a collection of skills, and the same professional may be highly expert in some of the tasks in her domain while remaining a novice in others. By the time chess players become experts, they have seen everything, or almost everything. But chess is an exception in this regard. Surgeons can be much more proficient in some operations than in others. Furthermore, some aspects of any professional's tasks are much easier to learn than others. Psychotherapists have many opportunities to observe the immediate reactions of patients to what they say. The feedback enables them to develop the intuitive skill to find words and the tone that will calm anger, forge confidence, or focus the patient's attention. On the other hand, therapists do not have a chance to identify which general treatment approach is most suitable for different patients. The feedback they receive from their patients' long-term outcomes is sparse, delayed, or usually non-existent, and in any case, too ambiguous to support learning from experience. Among medical specialties, anesthesiologists benefit from good feedback because the effects of their actions are likely to be quickly evident. In contrast, radiologists obtain little information about the accuracy of the diagnoses they make and about the pathologies they fail to detect. Anesthesiologists are therefore in a better position to develop useful intuitive skills. If an anesthesiologist says, "I have a feeling something is wrong," everyone in the operating room should be prepared for an emergency. Here again, as in the case of subjective confidence, the experts may not know the limits of their expertise. An experienced psychotherapist knows that she is skilled in working out what is going on in her patient's mind and that she has good intuitions about what the patient will say next. It is tempting for her to conclude that she can also anticipate how well the patient will do next year, but this conclusion is not equally justified. Short-term anticipation and long-term forecasting are different tasks, and the therapist has had adequate opportunity to learn one, but not the other. Similarly, a financial expert may have skills in many aspects of his trade, but not in picking stocks, and an expert in the Middle East knows many things, but not the future. The clinical psychologist, the stock picker, and the pundit do have intuitive skills in some of their tasks, but they have not learned to identify the situations and the tasks in which intuition will betray them. The unrecognized limits of professional skill help explain why experts are often overconfident. Evaluating validity. At the end of our journey, Gary Klein and I agreed on a general answer to our initial question. When can you trust an experienced professional who claims to have an intuition? Our conclusion was that for the most part, it is possible to distinguish intuitions that are likely to be valid from those that are likely to be bogus. As in the judgment of whether a work of art is genuine or a fake, you will usually do better by focusing on its provenance than by looking at the piece itself. If the environment is sufficiently regular, and if the judge has had a chance to learn its regularities, the associative machinery will recognize situations and generate quick and accurate predictions and decisions. You can trust someone's intuitions if these conditions are met. Unfortunately, associative memory also generates subjectively compelling intuitions that are false. Anyone who has watched the chess progress of a talented youngster knows well that skill does not become perfect all at once, and that on the way to near perfection, some mistakes are made with great confidence. When evaluating expert intuition, you should always consider whether there was an adequate opportunity to learn the cues, even in a regular environment. In a less regular or low validity environment, the heuristics of judgment are invoked. System 1 is often able to produce quick answers to difficult questions by substitution, creating coherence where there is none. The question that is answered is not the one that was intended, but the answer is produced quickly and may be sufficiently plausible to pass the lax and lenient review of System 2. You may want to forecast the commercial future of a company, for example, and believe that this is what you are judging, while in fact, Your evaluation is dominated by your impressions of the energy and competence of its current executives. Because substitution occurs automatically, you often do not know the origin of a judgment that you, your System 2, endorse and adopt. If it is the only one that comes to mind, it may be subjectively undistinguishable from valid judgments that you make with expert confidence. This is why subjective confidence is not a good diagnostic of accuracy. Judgments that answer the wrong question can also be made with high confidence. You may be asking, why did Gary Klein and I come up immediately with the idea of evaluating an expert's intuition by assessing the regularity of the environment and the expert's learning history, mostly setting aside the expert's confidence? And what did we think the answer could be? These are good questions, because the contours of the solution were apparent from the beginning. We knew from the outset that fireground commanders and pediatric nurses would end up on one side of the boundary of valid intuitions, and that the specialties studied by Neil would be on the other, along with stock pickers and pundits. It is difficult to reconstruct what it was that took us years, long hours of discussion, endless exchanges of drafts, and hundreds of emails, negotiating over words, and more than once almost giving up. But this is what always happens when a project ends reasonably well. Once you understand the main conclusion, it seems it was always obvious. As the title of our article suggests, Klein and I disagreed less than we had expected and accepted joint solutions of almost all the substantive issues that were raised. However, we also found that our early differences were more than an intellectual disagreement. We had different attitudes, emotions, and tastes, and those changed remarkably little over the years. This is most obvious in the facts that we find amusing and interesting. Klein still winces when the word bias is mentioned, and he still enjoys stories in which algorithms or formal procedures lead to obviously absurd decisions. I tend to view the occasional failures of algorithms as opportunities to improve them. On the other hand, I find more pleasure than Klein does in the comeuppance of arrogant experts who claim intuitive powers in zero validity situations. In the long run, however, finding as much intellectual agreement as we did is surely more important than the persistent emotional differences that remained. Speaking of expert intuition, how much expertise does she have in this particular task? How much practice has she had? Does he really believe that the environment of startups is sufficiently regular to justify an intuition that goes against the base rates? She is very confident in her decision, but subjective confidence is a poor index of the accuracy of a judgment. Did he really have an opportunity to learn? How quick and how clear was the feedback he received on his judgments? Chapter 23. The Outside View. A few years after my collaboration with Amos began, I convinced some of the officials in the Israeli Ministry of Education of the need for a curriculum to teach judgment and decision-making in high schools. The team that I assembled to design the curriculum and write a textbook for it included several experienced teachers, some of my psychology students, and Seymour Fox, then dean of the Hebrew University's School of Education, who was an expert in curriculum development. After meeting every Friday afternoon for about a year, we had constructed a detailed outline of the syllabus, had written a couple of chapters, and had run a few sample lessons in the classroom. We all felt that we had made good progress. One day, as we were discussing procedures for estimating uncertain quantities, the idea of conducting an exercise occurred to me. I asked everyone to write down an estimate of how long it would take us to submit a finished draft of the textbook to the Ministry of Education. I was following a procedure that we already planned to incorporate into our curriculum. The proper way to elicit information from a group is not by starting with a public discussion, but by confidentially collecting each person's judgment. This procedure makes better use of the knowledge available to members of the group than the common practice of open discussion. I collected the estimates and jotted the results on the blackboard. They were narrowly centered around 2 years. The low end was 1.5, the high end 2.5 years. Then I had another idea. I turned to Seymour, our curriculum expert, and asked whether he could think of other teams similar to ours that had developed a curriculum from scratch. This was a time when several pedagogical innovations like new math had been introduced, and Seymour said he could think of quite a few. I then asked whether he knew the history of these teams in some detail, and it turned out that he was familiar with several. I asked him to think of these teams when they had made as much progress as we had. How long, from that point, did it take them to finish their textbook projects? He fell silent. When he finally spoke, it seemed to me that he was blushing, embarrassed by his own answer. "You know, I never realized this before, but in fact, not all the teams at a stage comparable to ours ever did complete their task. A substantial fraction of the teams ended up failing to finish the job." This was worrisome. We had never considered the possibility that we might fail. My anxiety rising, I asked how large he estimated that fraction was. "About 40%, he answered. By now, a pall of gloom was falling over the room. The next question was obvious. "Those who finished," I asked, "how long did it take them?" "I cannot think of any group that finished in less than 7 years," he replied, "nor any that took more than 10. I grasped at a straw. "When you compare our skills and resources to those of the other groups, how good are we? How would you rank us in comparison with these teams?" Seymour did not hesitate long this time. "We're below average," he said. "But not by much." This came as a complete surprise to all of us, including Seymour, whose prior estimate had been well within the optimistic consensus of the group. Until I prompted him, there was no connection in his mind between his knowledge of the history of other teams and his forecast of our future. Our state of mind when we heard Seymour is not well described by stating what we knew. Surely all of us knew that a minimum of 7 years and a 40% chance of failure was a more plausible forecast of the fate of our project than the numbers we had written on our slips of paper a few minutes earlier. But we did not acknowledge what we knew. The new forecast still seemed unreal because we could not imagine how it could take so long to finish a project that looked so manageable. No crystal ball was available to tell us the strange sequence of unlikely events that were in our future. All we could see was a reasonable plan that should produce a book in about 2 years, conflicting with statistics indicating that other teams had failed or had taken an absurdly long time to complete their mission. What we had heard was base rate information, from which we should have inferred a causal story. If so many teams failed, and if those that succeeded took so long, writing a curriculum was surely much harder than we had thought. But such an inference would have conflicted with our direct experience of the good progress we'd been making. The statistics that Seymour provided were treated as base rates normally are, noted, and promptly set aside. We should have quit that day. None of us was willing to invest 6 more years of work in a project with a 40% chance of failure. Although we must have sensed that persevering was not reasonable, The warning did not provide an immediately compelling reason to quit. After a few minutes of desultory debate, we gathered ourselves together and carried on as if nothing had happened. The book was eventually completed 8 years later. By that time, I was no longer living in Israel and had long since ceased to be part of the team, which completed the task after many unpredictable vicissitudes. The initial enthusiasm for the idea in the Ministry of Education had waned by the time the text was delivered, and it was never used. This embarrassing episode remains one of the most instructive experiences of my professional life. I eventually learned 3 lessons from it. The first was immediately apparent. I had stumbled onto a distinction between 2 profoundly different approaches to forecasting, which Amos and I later labeled the inside view and the outside view. The second lesson was that our initial forecasts of about 2 years for the completion of the project exhibited a planning fallacy. Our estimates were closer to a best-case scenario than to a realistic assessment. I was slower to accept the 3rd lesson, which I call irrational perseverance, the folly we displayed that day in failing to abandon the project. Facing a choice, we gave up rationality rather than give up the enterprise. Drawn to the inside view. On that long ago Friday, our curriculum expert made 2 judgments about the same problem and arrived at very different answers. The inside view is the one that all of us, including Seymour, spontaneously adopted to assess the future of our project. We focused on our specific circumstances and searched for evidence in our own experiences. We had a sketchy plan. We knew how many chapters we were going to write, and we had an idea of how long it had taken us to write the 2 that we had already done. The more cautious among us probably added a few months to their estimate as a margin of error. Extrapolating was a mistake. We were forecasting based on the information in front of us. What you see is all there is. But the chapters we wrote first were probably easier than the others, and our commitment to the project was probably then at its peak. But the main problem was that we failed to allow for what Donald Rumsfeld famously called the unknown unknowns. There was no way for us to foresee, that day, the succession of events that would cause the project to drag out for so long. The divorces, the illnesses, the crises of coordination with bureaucracies that delayed the work could not be anticipated. Such events not only cause the writing of chapters to slow down, they also produce long periods during which little or no progress is made at all. The same must have been true, of course, for the other teams that Seymour knew about. The members of those teams were also unable to imagine the events that would cause them to spend 7 years to finish, or ultimately fail to finish, a project that they evidently had thought was very feasible. Like us, they did not know the odds they were facing. There are many ways for any plan to fail, and although most of them are too improbable to be anticipated, the likelihood that something will go wrong in a big project is high. The 2nd question I asked Seymour directed his attention away from us and toward a class of similar cases. Seymour estimated the base rate of success in that reference class, 40% failure and 7 to 10 years for completion. His informal survey was surely not up to scientific standards of evidence, but it provided a reasonable basis for a baseline prediction. The prediction you make about a case if you know nothing except the category to which it belongs. As we saw earlier, the baseline prediction should be the anchor for further adjustments. If you are asked to guess the height of a woman about whom you know only that she lives in New York City, your baseline prediction is your best guess of the average height of women in the city. If you are now given case-specific information, for example, that the woman's son is the starting center of his high school basketball team, you will adjust your estimate away from the mean in the appropriate direction. Seymour's comparison of our team to others suggested that the forecast of our outcome was slightly worse than the baseline prediction, which was already grim. The spectacular accuracy of the outside view forecast in our problem was surely a fluke and should not count as evidence for the validity of the outside view. The argument for the outside view should be made on general grounds. If the reference class is properly chosen, the outside view will give an indication of where the ballpark is, as it may suggest, as it did, in our case, that the inside view forecasts are not even close to it. For a psychologist, the discrepancy between Seymour's two judgments is striking. He had in his head all the knowledge required to estimate the statistics of an appropriate reference class, but he reached his initial estimate without ever using that knowledge. Seymour's forecast from his inside view was not an adjustment from the baseline prediction, which had not come to his mind. It was based on the particular circumstances of our efforts. Like the participants in the Tom W. experiment, Seymour knew the relevant base rate, but did not think of applying it. Unlike Seymour, the rest of us did not have access to the outside view and could not have produced a reasonable baseline prediction. It is noteworthy, however, that we did not feel we needed information about other teams to make our guesses. My request for the outside view surprised all of us, including me. This is a common pattern. People who have information about an individual case rarely feel the need to know the statistics of the class to which the case belongs. When we were eventually exposed to the outside view, we collectively ignored it. We can recognize what happened to us. It is similar to the experiment that suggested the futility of teaching psychology. When they made predictions about individual cases about which they had a little information, a brief and bland interview, Nisbet and Borghida's students completely neglected the global results they had just learned. Pallid statistical information is routinely discarded when it is incompatible with one's personal impressions of a case. In the competition with the inside view, the outside view doesn't stand a chance. The preference for the inside view sometimes carries moral overtones. I once asked my cousin, a distinguished lawyer, a question about a reference class. What is the probability of the defendant winning in cases like this one? His sharp answer that every case is unique was accompanied by a look that made it clear he found my question inappropriate and superficial. A proud emphasis on the uniqueness of cases is also common in medicine, in spite of recent advances in evidence-based medicine that point the other way. Medical statistics and baseline predictions come up with increasing frequency in conversations between patients and physicians. However, the remaining ambivalence about the outside view in the medical profession is expressed in concerns about the impersonality of procedures that are guided by statistics and checklists. The planning fallacy. In light of both the outside view forecast and the eventual outcome, the original estimates we made that Friday afternoon appear almost delusional. This should not come as a surprise. Overly optimistic forecasts of the outcome of projects are found everywhere. Amos and I coined the term planning fallacy to describe plans and forecasts that are unrealistically close to best-case scenarios, could be improved by consulting the statistics of similar cases. Examples of the planning fallacy abound in the experiences of individuals, governments, and businesses. The list of horror stories is endless. In July 1997, The proposed new Scottish Parliament building in Edinburgh was estimated to cost up to £40 million. By June 1999, the budget for the building was £109 million. In April 2000, legislators imposed a £195 million cap on costs. By November 2001, they demanded an estimate of final cost, which was set at £241 million. That estimated final cost rose twice in 2002, ending the year at £294.6 million. It rose three times more in 2003, reaching £375.8 million by June. The building was finally completed in 2004 at an ultimate cost of roughly £431 million. A 2005 study examined rail projects undertaken worldwide between 1969 and 1998. In more than 90% of the cases, the number of passengers projected to use the system was overestimated. Even though these passenger shortfalls were widely publicized, forecasts did not improve over those 30 years. On average, planners overestimated how many people would use the new rail projects by 106%, and the average cost overrun was 45%. As more evidence accumulated, the experts did not become more reliant on it. In 2002, a survey of American homeowners who had remodeled their kitchens found that, on average, they had expected the job to cost $18,658. In fact, they ended up paying an average of $38,769. The optimism of planners and decision-makers is not the only cause of overruns. Contractors of kitchen renovations and of weapons systems readily admit, though not to their clients, that they routinely make most of their profit in additions to the original plan. The failures of forecasting in these cases reflect the customer's inability to imagine how much their wishes will escalate over time. They ended up paying much more than they would if they had made a realistic plan and stuck to it. Errors in the initial budget are not always innocent. The authors of unrealistic plans are often driven by the desire to get the plan approved, whether by their superiors or by a client, supported by the knowledge that projects are rarely abandoned unfinished merely because of overruns in costs or completion times. In such cases, the greatest responsibility for avoiding the planning fallacy lies with the decision makers who approve the plan. If they do not recognize the need for an outside view, they commit a planning fallacy. Mitigating the planning fallacy. The diagnosis of and the remedy for the planning fallacy have not changed since that Friday afternoon, but the implementation of the idea has come a long way. The renowned Danish planning expert, Bent Flufjer, now at Oxford University, offered a forceful summary. The prevalent tendency to underweight or ignore distributional information is perhaps the major source of error in forecasting. Planners should therefore make every effort to frame the forecasting problem so as to facilitate utilizing all the distributional information that is available. This may be considered the single most important piece of advice regarding how to increase accuracy in forecasting through improved methods. Using such distributional information from other ventures similar to that being forecasted is called taking an outside view and is the cure to the planning fallacy. The treatment for the planning fallacy has now acquired a technical name, reference class forecasting. And Flufpierre has applied it to transportation projects in several countries. The outside view is implemented by using a large database which provides information on both plans and outcomes for hundreds of projects all over the world and can be used to provide statistical information about the likely overruns of cost and time and about the likely underperformance of projects of different types. The forecasting method that Fluffpierre applies is similar to the practices recommended for overcoming base rate neglect. 1. Identify an appropriate reference class. Kitchen.